Welcome, everybody, right here to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Yes, it's Thursday, so it's time for Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, agriculture, our energy, and our environment. Today, we're going to talk about a report called Diversifying the Agricultural Basket, Risks in Conventional Poultry Growing in Maryland's Eastern Shore, and Opportunities from Diversified Local Agriculture. Betsy Nichols, who is Executive Director of Waterkeepers Chesapeake, helped put all this together. Betsy, good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Aidan Irish, who is an Agricultural and Local Food Systems Policy Analyst and a PhD student in the John Glenn College of Public Affairs at Ohio State University. And Aidan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us once again is Carol Morrison, transitional farmer who went from producing industrial contract chickens for Purdue to raising her own chickens at Bird's Eye View Farm in Pocomoke City on the shore, on the Delmarva, where she raises free-range chickens for their eggs and sells them to the rest of us. And Carol, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me,
Doc. Always good to have you back. So where do we begin here? Let's begin, Betsy, I guess, about the genesis of this report.
Yes, so Waterkeepers Chesapeake has been working on this campaign called Fair Farms, really looking at a lot of different aspects of food, farming, and agriculture and how they come together to support our water and our communities. And as part of that question, we really wanted to look at some of the economics of what's going on with the poultry industry on the Eastern Shore. We've heard a lot of claims from the industry itself that, you know, more and bigger in consolidation results in better economies on the Eastern Shore. So we asked the question, is that true? Is that what the facts show? Is that what the economics show? Is that going to result in improvements across the board for farmers, for food, for systems, and for families? And so we got a researcher, Aidan Irish, a policy analyst, to help us look into that question and really dig into the facts and find out what they said from literature reviews, from historical studies with Rodale Institute, to on-the-ground case studies with people like Carol Morrison to find out what the facts were on this issue.
So we've talked a bunch about this on the show in the past, the question of the kind of monoculture that we have in Maryland that was once diversified. But the history of it is, and you talk about this in the report, but the history is that we should cover a little bit. And Aidan, if you want to jump into this right now, please do. But it's that that a lot of this industry, this explosive poultry industry, happened because of World War II and looking for inexpensive meat to feed soldiers and people in general. And then we had the growth of the contract farms over the last 50, 60 years it took to kind of build this industry. But that industry has really taken hold. I mean, it's there on most of the farms. Plus you have soy and corn that's being grown that feeds that industry. So how does that fit into kind of analysis of where we might be given the power of where we are and where it came from?
Well, I think it's important to realize that there are a variety of factors that have gone into where we are today in terms of poultry production. And you're right, that it has an explosive growth. Since the 1950s to as of the 2012 agricultural census, broiler production in the United States has grown from about 750 million chickens to 8.5 billion chickens. And that's an increase of 14-fold in a time period when the population slightly more than doubled. And you're right, a significant response comes out of World War II, but most importantly, most of that growth has come after World War II as a result of cheap feed crops, cheap corn and soybean prices, and because of changes in the market structure of the industry, as well as advances in technology and mechanization that make this advancement possible. But I think the biggest factor that we need to look at, that's important to look at in this industry, is the monopolization. Poultry, like much of the meat industry today, is a vertically integrated process. And essentially what that means is that a single company will own the entire process from the hatching of the chicks and the processing of the feed all the way through to the slaughter and distribution of the final product. Now, this is a highly capital-intensive industry, and through a lot of what we've seen throughout the agricultural sector has become concentrated in a small handful of companies. Now, about three companies control almost 50% of ready-to-cook chicken in the United States. So when we look at what the industry is today, that economic concentration, the monopolistic concentration, is a significant force to be taken into consideration.
So it has become this force. I mean, it literally is a force that controls a lot of our agriculture. So the question is, when you look at this, I mean, what jumped out at you all that you didn't expect to find? Anything?
I think there were a few different things. One was certainly an interesting factor about sustainability and the sustainable agriculture and looking at how it compared economically with these, you know, more intensive monopoly structures and the vertical integration, and that acre per acre, that you could have equal production but potentially higher economic yield. And those were based on, you know, 30 years of Rodale Institute studies showing this. And that was a pretty, pretty astonishing result, because not only do you get the higher economic yield, but you have internalized costs there. And what that means is that you're not putting costs of waste or pollution on taxpayers or on the community. They're actually included in those sustainable farming methods. So there's really a lot of advantages to diversifying and developing new and different techniques in farming.
Carol, let me get...
And that last point, I'd like, if I can jump in really quick.
Aiden, go ahead.
I think that's probably one of the most important things we want to take from this report is trying to point out, is that if we look at the broiler industry simply in terms of volume of production and total revenue generated, it has been enormously efficient. The purpose of this report, and that agriculture analysts in general are starting to step back and take a look at, is a more of a 10,000-foot perspective on the industry and exactly how we paying the price for that efficient production in other forms, whether it be in environmental pollution, in public health, in economic instability. And that's what this report is really looking at, is not just economic production, but what are those previously externalized costs that are resulting from that high volume production.
So, I mean, there are a couple things here as we walk through the report. And the question, one of the things you said, we talked about shifting where the money, there would be more money if you shifted to a diversified economy, you have a chance of making greater money. But let's talk about the difficulty with that. I mean, because you're talking about the marketplace and what the marketplace will bear. You know, one of the things, the reason people make money raising chickens, those who do, is because they can raise those chickens picked up by Purdue, Tyson, whoever else are raising them for. There's a market for those chickens all across the country, all across the globe. People buy them inexpensively, inexpensive chicken. Farmers grow the soy and the corn because it feeds that industry and other animal feed industries and other kind of industries around sugar. So where's the market? I mean, like Carol, you've had to fight and struggle to create a market for your chickens at mostly high-end grocery stores, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And here lately, there's been, you know, local sales to individuals, which I didn't really target. My target was one outlet. I guess you could say kind of like an experiment, because I had no idea what I was doing. It was kind of a fly by the seat of your venture, I did receive a USDA value-added producer grant, which allowed me to do a feasibility study, a marketing analysis, branding, business plan, and I used my actual figures from what I was doing here on the farm. And through it all, I found that, you know, there were astronomical net profits to be made, just targeting, you know, a high-end grocery store.
Right.
I'm not going to say a specialty grocery store, but a high-end grocery store. And I found also that the market at the high-end grocery store, I would never be able to fulfill. The opportunities there are endless.
That you could, you by yourself, you could not fulfill them. The demand was so great.
No, no, I would never be. I could had trouble fulfilling the orders of 7 stores, and you know it, that was with 1,200 hens.
So
buying everything.
So I'm going to come back to that. And see where it might go from here. But Aiden, so and the broader question here, though, is while the report shows, and as Betsy was talking about, the diversification can lead to greater profit in some ways, but part of that is theoretical because the profit right now is built in to the marketplace as it stands, which is built around large operations, whether you're talking about large organic operations like Driscoll in California, or whether you're talking about Purdue and Tyson Amount air-raising industrial chickens in Maryland, where there's this gigantic marketplace for them and also subsidies by the government. So is it not, Aiden, a leap to say that if you simply diversify, it's going to change the landscape?
Well, once again, I think the element that we need to take into account is not simply the market volume, but where else we're paying for that price of concentration. Now, the poultry industry, while enormous on the Maryland Eastern Shore, it's not the only industry on that shore, the other one notably being the commercial and recreational fishing industry. And when we take into account the production that comes from the poultry industry on the Maryland Eastern Shore, it's naive in the long term to discount the fact that that production comes with enormous waste production that has detrimental impacts on the sustainability of commercial and recreational fishing industry also in Maryland. So there are trade-offs here. If you look just at the poultry industry, like I was saying before, yes, it's been very efficient, but it's come at a price. Now, in terms of shifting to diversification, whether or not that's theoretical, I don't think it is right to say that it's theoretical. There is significant research by the Kellogg Biological Research Station, by the Rodale Institute, as Betsy has mentioned, and by practice by numerous farmers that point out that diversified, not just animal diversification, but crop diversification as well, can help better manage nutrient flows, nutrient cycles on farm, maintain the soil, limit soil erosion, and reduce that externalized pollution. The other component to keep in mind is that waste, external or pollution that runs off from a farm in the form of erosion is not only a pollution when it reaches the Chesapeake Bay, but it's also a lost resource because it's no longer in the field that where it is beneficial on that agricultural farmland. So that's the point here is that yes, while the poultry industry has been significant or has been successful in terms of gross production, that has come at a cost elsewhere that needs to be factored into the economic calculus.
So that, and I think that's part of the issue here. I think in many ways, Betsy, that we when we talk about the economy, when we talk about the future and building this diversification, let's say, we don't pollution, the effect on the bay, antibiotics in the chicken, the effect on the workers. who catch those chickens, who work those chickens, what the antibiotics are doing, again, in our environment and because of the mass use of chicken other than Purdue, which has stopped using antibiotics, that's not taken into account when you talk about how to develop something separately economically. It's like seen as a separate issue.
Correct. And that's a big part of the problem. What we're trying to do, and you know, what we were really asking in this report is, who do we want to benefit? And we want to take much more of a community viewpoint on this, looking at agriculture as something that benefits entire communities. And in that way, you have to consider these externalized costs and problems, such as public health risks, such as impact on the bay, such as the loss of oysters and crabs caused by pollution and runoff. So we want to make sure that farmers and businesses are able to produce chicken and other livestock and feed the communities, but not at the expense of everything else. So we're looking for what systems can work and feed, you know, all of these needs at the same time.
I mean, so part of the battle here is, in terms of changing the way we think about this, is for people to begin to think on a larger scale, to incorporate these factors in to what it means to have an agricultural economy. And that's part of the problem.
Absolutely. It really is a new way of thinking about things. And we've had things, you know, so many different factors working against us in this, in this arena for a long time, from, you know, things you mentioned of subsidies for corn and soybean and, you know, that build this structure up against us. But, you know, it took us over 65 years to get into this system of consolidation.
Right.
We can start working on developing a new system that's going to work better for our future.
So let's talk about what that means. So what does it mean to make a new system? And if the majority of farmers on the Eastern Shore, which is where most of the poultry industry is located, if the majority of farmers are involved in one level or other with industrial poultry production, because that's how people are making their living or attempting to make their living, then how does that begin to change? I mean, how do you really, we've gone around and around about this for years. I mean, so how does that, what are the ideas that came out of this report and your thoughts on what that transition looks like?
There are a few different things that are pretty straightforward, and some of them I think are going to be a little bit more difficult to implement. In terms of the straightforward things, I mean, we have a waste issue, that we have a concentration of chicken houses and chicken waste in a really small area. So we have to immediately address that problem, find a source to move the waste, regulate that waste, stop combining it in the same area, and stop adding to the problem by consolidating in that same region. Another thing is the antibiotics. As you mentioned, that we have a huge problem with antibiotic resistance, and that's largely from livestock, from antibiotic use, not to treat sickness, but to prevent sickness in animals.
Right.
And we already have companies that are stepping up and making changes, like Purdue, as you mentioned. So that's where that starts. And consumers can really push that forward on their own with their buying habits and, buy products that don't have antibiotics. And that will really change the marketplace on that. So those are some things that can happen pretty quickly that will make, you know, a big difference. To get to the point of diversification is really, you know, getting in touch with some of these companies and understanding some of the risks. We've just seen firsthand some of the risks, you know, of having all of these chicken houses consolidated in one place in North Carolina, where we had Hurricane Matthew come through and chicken houses and hog farms were flooded. Dead animals floating all over the place, disease spreading in those populations. That really poses a huge threat on the Eastern Shore, where we have the same potential risks from sea level rise, from climate change, and the same vulnerabilities there. So there is great advantage to diversification in livestock, in different crops. So getting that sort of awareness amongst the farmers, amongst the businesses, to explore those opportunities. outside of just the one crop, one model system. And also, you know, having a bigger investment in local agriculture, in things like food hubs, in CSAs, community-supported agriculture, investing in those things and helping support local farm economies. When you buy at the grocery store, farmers only get about 12 cents on the dollar. But when you buy directly from a farmer, they get all of that money. So trying to find new ways to develop those methods can really help support farmers' economies.
So from...
Could I jump in there?
Carol, I was about to ask you to take the perspectives of farmers. I was going to ask Aiden to take a perspective in a macro level. Go ahead, Carol.
I, in addition to what Betsy is saying, I really think that there is a great lack of education for farmers. Or potential farmers, beginning farmers. If you look at getting into farming here in this area, the only thing that is promoted is industrial agriculture. Whether it be through state-supported programs or federal-supported programs, where you go to get your information, universities, everything is geared toward industrial agriculture. There is nothing there to show opportunities for other types of agriculture. And I think that is sorely lacking.
Aiden, what were you about to say? I thought I heard you.
Well, that's an education point is a really great point. And this is not just within Maryland, but nationally, the average age of farmers in the United States is increasing steadily.
Yeah.
And that's not being replaced since 1952. Today, we've gone from 6 million farmers in the United States to fewer than 2 million, still managing 51% of the national land area is held in agriculture and rangeland. And that land is an important, not only agricultural production resource, but also a critical land environmental management resource. The point that I'd also like to add, in addition to the educational component, there is a significant lack of distributed infrastructure that has occurred along with this concentration. And I'm sure Carol will attest to this in her personal experience. But while the poultry industry is enormous on the Maryland Eastern Shore, it is enormously difficult for individual growers operating outside of a growing contract with a meat production company to get access to chicks, to get access to feed, to a feed mill, and to get access to a slaughter facility. I believe there is one mobile slaughter unit for small-scale production on the entire mid-Atlantic region. So one of the critical areas that needs to be obstacles that needs to be overcome, and a reason that local food systems, community-supported agriculture, food hubs, these community endeavors, those can be enormously helpful, is in pooling resources for the development of critical infrastructure such as slaughter facilities. I believe Carol, I was talking to her some time ago, and you were talking about the difficulty of getting old chickens to slaughter, and that was not a feasible option because there isn't availability of that. And that is a critical issue, not just in the Maryland Eastern Shore, but throughout the country in areas that are dominated by industrial operations. And that lack of infrastructure, combined with the prevalence of the industrial industry, limits the ability of individual growers to actually have a choice. Theoretically, they have a choice to sell someplace else, but lack of infrastructure makes that practically impossible. So that infrastructure component needs to be overcome.
Also, in the state of Maryland, when we talk about, the mobile slaughter unit and on-farm slaughtering, which is allowed up to a certain extent, I believe it's 20,000 chickens, the rules and regulations, you're expected now, or you have to now, recapture wastewater from that process. Well, if you're going to do it on farm, you have to figure out a way to do this. If not, you need a processing plant that has the capabilities of recapturing wastewater. So it has been made so hard for the small farmer to even think about doing it. You know, they don't know where to start. I just think that it's an uphill battle where there's no support there for the small farmer.
Because in the report itself, and one of the things in the report is you're, Carol, talking about or your situation where you have to buy your chicks from New Mexico and the feed from Pennsylvania and how difficult that is to get the things you want, right? So that's what kind of begs the question is you have this report here about the future should lie in diversification of agriculture, but getting to that point is what I think is the question I'm trying to pursue. And I think that and how you create this world. I mean, Aidan, are there examples of places where this is actually happening, where we are talking about this kind of model being developed?
Well, this model implies a singular model. And this is one of the issues that is actually central to what we need to overcome. Industrial agriculture, like much of the industrialized world, is predicated on the assertion that there is a single method of production that is applicable universally. Now, agriculture is necessarily an environmentally based production sector. It is based in the local ecosystem in which it operates. It depends on it. So agriculture and the food systems will look significantly different in Eastern Shore of Maryland or Maryland generally compared to, say, Southern California. Now, that being said, there are places in the world that have been for some time experimenting with local food systems development. A notable example is the city of Belo Horizonte, Brazil, which has been working on local food systems production as a means of solving its urban food insecurity issues, while at the same time tackling the economic insecurity of small farmers in the periphery peri-urban areas around the city. More close to home, city of Seattle right now has been developed since 2012. Has been developing its local food system plan. And not only for the city itself, city of Seattle itself, but working with adjacent counties or in a rural area such as in the Snoqualmie Valley east of the city to purchase and preserve farmland and to develop, help support the development of infrastructure to foster small-scale diversified farming efforts. Mm-hmm. So this is not something that is completely untried. And those are only two of dozens, if not hundreds, of examples. The other thing to keep in mind is we are, in essence, taking a look back at history to say what has worked in the past. Historically, local food systems or food systems in general were not thought of as being something to be planned because they were, by the nature of the lack of infrastructure, by the lack of technology, they had to be local to be effective at all. Agriculture today looks very different than it did 100 years ago. It will look very different 100 years from now compared to what it looks like now or what it did 100 years ago. But that being said, there are significant lessons we can draw about things that were perhaps taken for granted or pushed out by the supposed efficiency of industrialized methods and international food markets that could potentially benefit from incorporating some of those lessons back into current agricultural policy.
So it seems to me that as we wrap up here, that one of the things that this report is really fascinating, when it raises the issues of what diversification could mean and what the problems with the lack of it has meant to the environment and to agricultural and to the business of agriculture itself. But it almost seems to beg the question of the steps being taken to politically and agriculturally, economically redefine the agricultural landscape. It's no easy trick, but I mean, that's what it would seem to take, Betsy. It's not just you know, I mean, Carol talks about how difficult it is for her to supply a store. And then those are high-end stores. We're talking about really feeding the nation and feeding people in a community with a diversified system takes complete rethinking of what agriculture is and how that system works.
I think that's true. And I think that part of the diversifying the system means not that everyone within the system has to be using the same diversified system. There are people within the system who are doing great in the monoculture integrated system. They've put in excellent best management practices, are doing a good job of controlling things coming off of their property and are keeping things clean, and it's working out economically for them. Great. You know, perhaps for them, keeping things going the same way makes sense. But there are a lot of people for whom it is not working at all, whether they can't control their pollutants, whether it does not work economically, whether they're at risk, whether there are public health problems in the community, all of these other reasons. Let's consider other options. And that's where it makes sense to not have all of our government subsidies just go to things like corn and soybean, just go to the industrialized model. Let's explore other opportunities for farmers, for our communities, for our systems.
So that's that, and therein lies political questions. So, Carol, a closing thought from you as the farmer in the midst here.
I agree with everything that's being said, and from a personal standpoint as a farmer, I can't even tell you how many years I thought about alternatives for the farm while we were doing contract farming. And I couldn't come up with anything because there was nothing there to point me in a direction that would be a viable operation. You know, everywhere I looked, there was nothing there. And I kept, you know, I'm a dreamer. I kept dreaming and dreaming, you know, if only we could do something else with this farm. So I think the idea of exploring it and finding alternatives and pointing farmers in the right direction is sorely needed. And that's a personal standpoint, you know, from what happened with me and, you know, just the dream of wanting to do something different.
But this is really interesting report. I think it's important. I mean, we have to heighten this discussion if we're going to make it work at all, and talk about what change would really take. And I this is always kind of a very powerful conversation to have, and I really appreciate the work that Betsy Nichols, Executive Director of Waterkeepers Chesapeake, is doing and getting this stuff out. And we should really kind of take this out and really have these larger discussions about what this would mean and push this notion of the difficulty and the importance of where we have to take this. Aidan Irish did an incredible job in writing this report and getting this report together, who's getting his PhD at the John Glenn, College of Public Affairs at Ohio State University, agricultural and local food systems policy analyst. Aidan, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And always great to talk to Carol Morrison, transitional of the farm, one of our great farmers out there, Bird's Eye View Farm in Pocomoke City, where she raises her chickens in a very free, loving way. And I've met her and her chickens out there.
They love visitors.
And I like their eggs. And so where can people see this report, Betsy?
We have it on our website online at Fair Farms, www.fairfarmsnow.org/diversify report.
So check that out, and we'll be coming back to this and having more ranging discussions on how we can change the way we farm. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, folks. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show. And in our continuing coverage of Maryland traditions, we're about to have a conversation with Leo Schinholt, who is Maryland's largest maple sugar maker, a recipient of the Maryland State Heritage Award. Also joined by Chad Betterbaugh, who is the co-director of Maryland Traditions with the Maryland State Arts Council. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks.
Leo, welcome. Good to have you with us, man.
Well, glad to be with you, sir.
So let's take a trip to Cumberland. I wish we actually could be there so I could taste it. You run this operation called the S&S Maple Camp, right?
Yes. My farm is in Cache Valley, right across the creek from Corganville, Maryland.
So give us the history of this farm.
Well, my grandparents bought this farm in 1931, and they farmed here and worked public works, and then they raised me, and about 1958 to 60, I become interested. I was just a young boy in maple syrup. So I tapped some trees here on the farm, which were blessed with a lot of beautiful sugar maple. And I made my first syrup when I was probably 10, 12 years old. And my grandpap helped me, and we worked at it till I left for the Army in 66. 20th of March, 66, and when I come back, went to Vermont, me and my grandmother and girlfriend, and bought a new evaporator, and that's how it started, and then we just kept building and building.
So let's take a step back for a minute. So, because we use terms like evaporator, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't know what that means, but, I mean, people put maple syrup on their pancakes and lots of other things, you know, all the time, but we don't really have a sense of where it comes from and what you do to get it out of the tree, what it means to tap a tree, what it means to heat up the maple syrup. So tell us a story about how you make your maple syrup.
Okay, well, in the spring of the year, and the times have changed. Used to be that around the 12th day of February, we would start to drill our tree. But the weather has changed so much that what it takes is a freezing night and a thawing day. It's when the trees are springing back to life and the water comes from the roots to the bud pocket to make a bud that makes a leaf. All right, we're catching a small percentage of that water, and which is usually 2% sugar, and that's what we process into maple syrup. And the times have changed. We used to do all buckets. Now we have a lot of tubing, and even to the fact we use vacuum on our tubing, that really is a big thing, and the whole sugar industry is turning over to vacuum systems, which produces about one-third more yield per tap hole than just a regular tap. And we used to drill 7/16 holes in the tree, 2 inches deep. We now drill a 3/8 hole in the tree, and it produces as much, and it's not as hard on the tree. But it's complicated, but yet it's very simple.
Yeah, I understand. Exactly. You put it just how I was about to say that. I'm glad you said it that way, too. I mean, and you know, the thing about, I was thinking about this, I watched my sister before she just recently passed away, but she lived in the mountains of West Virginia, and she used to tap, I forget the tree, but she tapped it too. It had a peppermint flavor. It was a birch tree. She was tapping birch trees.
Okay.
For a peppermint flavored syrup. And I watched her do that same kind of thing. So, and you have all grades of syrup, right? That you make?
Yes, we make all grades what we can. Well, the grading system, the first of the year, has changed. And I've seen it change 3 times in my lifetime. But now the grading system coincides with the Canadians, and which is good. The light is called a delicate, rich taste. And then you have an amber rich, and then you have a dark robust, and the very dark strong taste. And what we can is the rich taste and the dark robust. And the dark robust is a darker color, stronger in flavor, and it is really the best seller, especially it's used a lot. A lot of people associate maple syrup with pancakes. However, times have changed. It is now into the medical industry. They find that it's a cancer fighter. We have a recipe.
A cancer fighter. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Huh.
Yes, they're using it in fighting cancer. And I have a recipe out there in the building. Well, matter of fact, I just made a copy for some folks to come in this week. They're both battling cancer, and it's a mixture of pure maple syrup and baking soda.
Leo, one of the reasons I love listening to you is that...
This is Chad Butterball.
We can hear that phrase from you, times have changed from when you started doing this, and that to us at Maryland Traditions is one of the markers of a true tradition bearer. And that's part of the reason that we're thinking about the maple syrup tradition out there in Western Maryland. And in particular, Leo, who has been doing it in his family since the late 1960s, right, Leo?
Well, it was around 1960 that I started. My grandpap helped me, and I just had an interest. Why? I don't know, but I did, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, it's so wonderful to be working with Leo, and we're working with another family of maple syrup producers as well, the Stoyers of Garrett County, on the Heritage Awards this year. But I can't tell you the number of people that I talk to here around Baltimore, maybe get out to the Eastern Shore, and they say, boy, I never think about Maryland as a maple syrup producing state. But of course, you think about it, those two westernmost counties, and probably more than that, that's Appalachia. That's a different region altogether. So I suppose it's true what they say about the state being a microcosm of the country.
We get
different geography, different cultures, different traditions. And so it's been great getting to know you, Leo, and the Sawyers as well. So yeah, we're looking forward to November. By the way, November 11th, we're having our Maryland Traditions Heritage Awards at the Cultural Arts Center of Montgomery College down there in Silver Spring, 7995 Georgia Avenue. That's a free event, starts at 7:30 p.m. And Leo, along with the Stoyer family, are coming out from Western Maryland to receive their award in the tradition category, maple syrup making, and just talk a little bit about what they do.
Well, I am looking forward, Leo, to one day in the near future really tasting your syrup. Really am. Maybe it'd be fun to get up there and just do a walk through the woods with you and just do a little story of our own watching you do your work.
That would be great.
This is great.
Bring your boots would be my advice.
I have plenty of boots.
Okay, good.
And I don't mind walking. In the woods, I love it. So, so Leo Schinholt, we've been talking to him. He's Maryland's largest maple sugar maker. Getting the Maryland State Heritage Award coming up.
That's right.
Chad Butterbaugh is with us, who, of course, is Butterbaugh, excuse me.
That's right.
I'm sorry, man. Butterbaugh, who is co-director of the Maryland Traditions for the Maryland State Arts Council. Chad Butterbaugh, always good to see you.
Good to see you, Mark.
And Leo Schinholt, great to make your acquaintance and look forward to tasting this incredible syrup of yours. Thank you so much for your time and the work you do for us.
Well, thank you, sir.
Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA. I'm Mark Gunnery. We've been highlighting on Soundbites today some of the work that Maryland Traditions is doing, and this is one of the events that they are promoting. And so I'm here with Freddie Herbert, the Vice President of the Church Council at the Zion Lutheran Church of the City of Baltimore, which is hosting a sour beef and dumplings dinner. And I'm here with Chad Butterbaugh, co-director of Maryland Traditions with the Maryland State Arts Council. And Freddie and Chad, welcome.
Thanks. Mark.
So please tell me about the sour beef and dumplings dinner.
Well, it's about a 100-year-old tradition. The Ladies Aid Society of Zion has always been very active in fundraising. And we start working with the beef a week before, so we, trim 500 pounds of beef and then marinate it for several days, make the stock that goes into the gravy. The lard that we use to, sear the meat in. And then the day of the event, we'll get as many people there as possible and roll 2,000 dumplings. And we do the same thing on Thursday, where it's even more of a challenge because we serve lunch on Thursday. So we have to, roll quickly. And there's a real art to rolling dumplings. You know, you can't have any dimples or smiles or they'll fall apart.
So this is both a German tradition and a Baltimore tradition, right?
Yes, yeah. It used to be quite popular in all the different churches, but even church suppers are pretty much dying out.
Mm-hmm.
People would talk about the smell of sour beef just wafting through the whole city. And sour beef in itself is a Baltimore term. And the story that I've heard is that the German immigrants wanting to assimilate changed the name of sauerbraten to sour beef.
Mm-hmm. So what does it taste like for people who are not familiar with it?
It's a sweet and sour kind of gravy. The gravy is the most challenging and really the most wonderful part of the meal, and it's that sweet sour, you know. And of course, with the German ladies, it's either too sweet or too much vinegar or not sour enough. It's wonderful to be in the kitchen. You know, too much salt. No, there's no salt. You know, we have worked that out. But in the 50s, when many of the ladies that are there that are stopping now, there was a true hierarchy of who could do what, when, and for how long. I mean, I know. Well, I guess maybe 10 years ago. It took me a while to work my way into the kitchen because the kitchen was Adele and Betty's territory. I mean, they were in their 80s, but, you know, it was their territory and you had to kind of slide in there and befriend them.
So how did you manage it?
I think I started opening cans for them because we also do red cabbage and green beans and so I think that's how we got in there. And then, you know, as I said, the mantle has been turning over for who can do it. Who does what? And, you know, Leslie does the lion's share of the work now and her recruits.
And Leslie is the other member of our team of masters that we worked with last year at Maryland Traditions. We do our apprenticeship program every year where we identify traditions that have both experts and interested learners. Mm-hmm. So Leslie and Freddie were our two masters, and of course their subject is the sour beef and dumpling dinner, and they worked with an apprentice, Jeff Smith, to pass the knowledge on and to ensure that this tradition gets carried forward.
And why do you think it's important to be carrying on these traditions, and especially in the context of having like masters and apprentices?
Well, I think that we have a lot of ways to remind ourselves who we are, maybe as a nation, as a state. But when it comes to that more intimate level of city or cultural group or even family, we have to develop more intimate ways of expressing our culture. And that's sort of what folk life is. Mm-hmm. It's those traditions of inherited or passed down expressions that kind of remind us where we belong and who we are. And the apprenticeship program is our way as a state, as the Maryland State Arts Council, of passing traditions forward. And in fact, many states have similar apprenticeship programs where folk and traditional artists would be working together in that way.
Freddie, can you tell me a little bit about the history of the Zion Church?
The Zion congregation was founded in 1755, and immigration helped it to grow. And in 1808, they built the church that is there now. It's kind of interesting because the history says that the first church was built by the members of wood, and it sat on a hill, a sandy hill on Fish Street, which is now Saratoga Street, across from Jonestown, you know, which is now Jones Falls Expressway. And then we moved around the corner to Gay Street and built the bigger church in 1808. And we've been there ever since. And we still continue to have worship services in German at 9:15 every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And then English is at 11:15.
So one more part of the sour beef and dumpling dinner is the beer. Will you tell me a little bit about the beer that you'll be serving at this?
I believe we're serving Hofbrauhaus this year.
Mm-hmm.
Sour beef used to be a very formal affair at Zion. It was in the dining room. We have our own dish, plate service. What was that called? Anyway, all the dishes are designed with the Zion Z.
Oh, like the flatware or the
yes.
sort of yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not flatware, silverware.
Oh, that's the silverware. Boy, I don't spend much time in the kitchen. You can tell.
Anyway, it was white linen tablecloths and real dishes. Several years ago, we also opened up upstairs as a beer hall. So that's served in a cafeteria kind of style. And we have beer and wine to go with your meal.
It's just a gorgeous space up there.
It is a gorgeous
ceilings space.
From
the arched ceilings and the stained glass. It's a pretty special place to be.
Well, and you have to see it now because we were just lucky enough to be able to fix the peeling paint and repaint it and clean all the carved beams. And it looks fabulous.
Oh, great. I can't wait to see it.
Well, come on down.
So people can come out today, Thursday. What time is that?
We serve lunch in the formal dining room from 11 to 2.
Mm-hmm.
And we serve upstairs in the beer hall starting at 4. We also do carry out both days.
Mm-hmm. So people can just come by. Where is Zion Lutheran Church for people who want to come out tonight?
It's right across the street from City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
The parish house and garden face War Memorial Plaza, and people enter through the garden gates. The front of the church sits on the corner between of Gay and Lexington.
Mm-hmm. Great. That is Freddie Herbert, Vice President of the Church Council of the Zion Lutheran Church of the City of Baltimore, and Chad Butterbaugh, Co-Director of Maryland Traditions with the Maryland State Arts Council. And Freddie and Chad, thanks so much for telling us about this.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. You can also learn more about Soundbites and listen to past episodes at soundbitesradio.org. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.